Now it's going. All right. As I was saying, I want to talk about an alternative model, and it's a model which I am going to argue is which was in fact decentralized and privately enforced, historically common. I will at least argue that many and perhaps most surviving legal systems show evidence of having been constructed on top of a pre-existing system of what I'm calling feud law. And I'm going to argue that in substance, though not in form, feud law is still with us. It still describes human interactions, even if not ones that we call law enforcement. And I should add, because it always confuses people, the word feud and the word feudal have nothing to do with each other. They are etymologically unrelated, they happen to sound similar, and they describe different systems. So I am not talking about feudal law, I'm talking about feud law. And the logic of feud law is very simple, and that is that if you wrong me, I threaten to harm you unless you compensate me for the wrong. All right? And then, in order for that to work, there are a variety of conditions you have to meet. One of them is you have to have some mechanism such that right makes might. That is to say, you don't want a system where I can invent an injury you've done to me and demand you pay me off for it, because then it becomes straight extortion. So you need some way in which my threat to harm you is more believable when you really have wronged me than when you haven't. That's one of the requirements. Further problem is you've got to have some way of getting me to carry out my threat. Because after all, you wrong me, I threaten to harm you, and you say, you do that, I'll beat you up. All right? So there's got to be some reason why I don't back down, why I can commit myself that if you have wronged me, I'll go to a good deal of trouble to punish you unless you agree to compensate me. And indeed, you want a commitment mechanism that survives the death of the person who is committed. Because you want some way in which if somebody kills me, he still has to pay compensation or else get killed or in some way hurt himself. So you need some social mechanism that lets people, in effect, commit themselves past death. You need some way in which the mechanism can work for weak people. Some way in which, even if I don't have much ability to harm people, I can still, in a system of feud law, somehow protect my rights by making it costly to injure me, to attack me. And you want to avoid what people imagine feuds being like. Namely, you harm me, I threaten you, you don't back down, I harm you, you say, aha, I'll now get you, and back and forth and back and forth. That doesn't seem to be what really happens, at least in the feud systems I've looked at, but you need some way of preventing that from happening. How do you do these things? I've looked at a bunch of different legal systems. This is partly coming out of the book I'm now working on legal systems, very different. And let me describe at one extreme the legal system of Saga Period Iceland, which I've been writing about for a long time. If people are really interested, read the web chapter draft for my new book, because I discovered there were some mistakes in my previous work on it as a result of reading through a whole bunch of stuff. But the basic logic there is that the Icelandic settlement starts in about 870 AD, and the legal system is more or less set up in 930 AD. And finally collapses in the 1260s. So it lasts for about a third of a millennium. Last 50 years are pretty bad, but probably not as bad as 1861 to 65 here, say. But certainly people got killed. But the system was one in which there was a legislature, there was a court system, there were laws, but there was no executive arm of government. So all enforcement of court verdicts was private. And the basic logic of it is, it's a fascinating system. I could give a whole lecture on that one, though I won't today. But it was one in which if somebody kills, say, your brother or your son or your father, you sue them. And in principle, if the case goes all the way through, they can get outlawed, which means it's not legal to kill them. But in practice, almost all of those cases get settled out of court, just like a modern tort case, normally for a money payment. There were occasionally other terms to the agreement. But the point of that system, in a sense, is that the reason why right makes might is that after I've won the court case, which says you owe me 200 ounces of silver, now everybody in Iceland knows that I'm the good guy and you're the bad guy. And therefore, when I come after you, your friends don't defend you, because if they do, somebody will sue them. Whereas my friends are willing to help me. And so the result is that in practice, if you end up owing money, you either pay or you get out of Iceland, pretty much. So Roman child gypsies, I should say the Roman child gypsies are a feud system that currently exists. The Roman Chal are the largest gypsy group in England, and I got my information in them from one chapter of a book on gypsy law. Gypsies are also fascinating. The gypsies, the ancestors of the gypsies, left India about 1,000 years ago, and they scattered. And the result is you've got a bunch of different gypsy communities in different places which have evolved independently with certain elements in common, but not all the same legal system. And the Roman Chal have what's essentially a feud system, but it's an informal feud system. I like to say that the modern Roman Chal have a primitive version of the Icelandic system of 1,000 years earlier. Because what happens in the Roman Chal system is if you wrong me, I threaten to beat you up. There is no explicit law, but there's a set of community norms. It's a relatively small group where people know what's right behavior and wrong behavior. So if in fact you wronged me, your friends won't back you and my friends will back me. And therefore, if you wronged me, you either compensate me or leave town. That's the basic logic of the Roman Chal. Somali is another interesting case. The traditional system of northern Somalia was a stateless system, a little bit like the Icelandic, though not very much. And that was a system in which there was a traditional law, not a legislature, and in which there were mechanisms for setting up a court when a dispute happened, such that the other people in the society would recognize this is a legitimate procedure, and therefore you ought to go along with the verdict of that court. But again, the ultimate enforcement is all private. It's all a matter of people being willing to use violence. I'll come back to Somali more as we discuss solving some of the other problems. So all of these are designed to solve two problems. One of them is how do you prevent threats just being used for extortion, which is obviously one risk in this kind of system. And one of them is how do you get a verdict which isn't just, I think I'm right and therefore I'm right. Because as was pointed out long ago, every man is a biased judge in his own case. So in all of these, you've got some mechanism so that outside parties are called in. A explicit court mechanism in the Icelandic case, an informal one in the Roman Chal, a explicit but ad hoc court in the Somali system. So those are the mechanisms by which might makes right. What about the commitment mechanisms? And people often claim, people who want to argue against taxation is theft or similar slogans, say, look, all that property you claim to own only exists because the government has laws defending property, so therefore you really shouldn't be claiming it at all. To which my response is that private property not only pre-exists the existence of government, it pre-exists the existence of the human species. Because there is a primitive form of property which exists in some animal species. It's called territorial behavior. It's common in birds and fishes mostly. And the logic of territorial behavior is that one member of a species somehow marks the territory it's claiming. And it then, I like to think of it as turning a switch in its brain, which commits itself to fight more and more desperately against a trespasser of its own species that comes onto its territory. And why does this work? The reason it works is that unless the trespasser is much stronger than the defender, a fight to the death is a loss for both parties. All right? The question is not can you win it, is it worth winning? So if you're a little bit bigger than the bird that's defending your territory, you're another bird of the same species and sex. You could trespass, you could try to get food there, but the other one would fight more and more desperately, and when it's over, the other one is dead and you're badly hurt. Not worth doing. So the result in territorial behavior is that usually, once the trespasser is confronted by the property claimant, it backs off. And I want to claim that really human property institutions are just a much fancier version of that system. There's a, I've got an article which you can get from my webpage on a positive account of property rights, which is looking at them essentially from a sort of a strategic game theory standpoint, and you can find the same argument in the third edition of Machinery of Freedom and some of the new material. But in any case, one of the reasons why when somebody wrongs you, you threaten to harm him is that you want revenge. You feel vengeful. And people often think of that as a sort of an irrational passion. But in fact, I want to argue that it's rational from an evolutionary standpoint. That is to say, having a tendency to want to get back at people who hurt you is a desirable characteristic as long as other people know about it. Because it's the reason not to hurt you. And therefore, you can think of the feeling of vengefulness as being a sort of a hardwired commitment strategy built into us. Then, in addition to that, there are a variety of external mechanisms that we use in order to make the commitment work, in order to make sure that when you're harmed, you really are willing to go to a good deal of trouble to get back at the one who's harmed you unless he compensates you, our equivalent of the bird or the fish defending his territory. One obvious one is that if everybody knows you're a wimp, they'll stamp all over you. So you have an incentive, if you can, to avenge wrongs or, again, to insist on compensation for not avenging wrongs in order that other people won't violate your rights. More generally, being a wimp is seen as in human society as shameful. You lose status. That's a bad thing. And one of the interesting patterns you get, and I've observed this both in the Icelandic sources and in the Comanche sources. The Comanche, by the way, are my favorite response to the argument that an anarchist society can't possibly defend itself. Because the Comanche were a stateless society, and the problem was everybody else in that part of the world defending themselves against the Comanche for quite a long time. They eventually lost. But they stopped expansion across Texas for about 20 years, despite the fact that they were heavily outnumbered and technologically inferior. They were just very good at fighting. And they had a society in which you got status by raiding, getting slaves, stealing horses, stuff like that. But in any case, both the Comanche and the Icelandic, one of the patterns you get is that somebody who is relatively weak is the victim of an offense. And somebody who is strong offers to be his champion. Offers to say, look, I'll take this over. Don't have to pay me. You can collect the damages if there are any damages. I'll just face down that guy who injured you because I'm going to get status out of the fact that I can do that. And that's a pattern you observe in both of those societies. How do you enforce your rights after you're dead? The Icelandic system, the answer is that when somebody kills you, that's a tort from our standpoint. He now owes a damage payment to your heirs, or else he can get outlawed, or both. And so your heirs have an incentive to go after him to collect that damage payment. So in the Somali system, I guess the only two societies I know of that have a real social contract are the Somali and the Amish. And the Amish aren't a feud society, so I'm not discussing them this time, but you can read my chapter on the Amish, who are really fascinating people. But in any case, the Somali have this elaborate system of coalitions, sort of a nested set of coalitions. So you've got one small group, which is basically descendants of the same grandfather, roughly. But it doesn't have to be kinship, that these groups are created by a combination of kinship and contract. So you can have members of the group who are not your relatives but have agreed to be part of your dia-paying group is the term that the English anthropologists, I think, used for it. But they're nested. So you've got this small group, and when you run into a conflict with somebody stronger, that small group is a subpart of a larger group, which is a subpart of a still larger group. So it sort of moves up until you've got roughly equal numbers on each side. And the Dia paying group, Dia is the Arabic term actually for what the Norse called wergeld, damage payment for killing somebody. And I think the reason it gets used in the literature on the Somali is that the anthropologists who studied the Somali had studied the Bedouin first, and so they were used to using the term Dia. There's a different term in Somali, which I don't remember. But the basic idea was, this is a group of people who have agreed that if you wrong somebody and owe damages, they will share part of the cost of the damages. If someone wrongs you and owes you damages, they will collect a part of the damages. And if somebody has wronged you and owes damages and doesn't pay them, they will help you to collect. So it's a pre-existing coalition which exists for the purpose of handling paying off damages, collecting damages, and enforcing your rights. And therefore, even if you're a dad, presumably your Dia paying group still has a claim for the Dia for your killing, or your kin does, but through their group. So that's sort of one of the interesting systems. I should say, for people who are interested in Somalia, which is an interesting case, what basically happens with Somalia, in particular northern Somalia, is that you have a functional system. England is nominally ruling northern Somalia and Italy southern Somalia, but mostly the English at least are leaving things largely alone. In about 1960, they decide Somalia should be a country. And so England and Italy pull out, and they set up a democratic, modern nation state in Somalia, combining northern and southern. And that lasts for a few years and then turns into a military dictatorship. And the military dictator gets into a war with Ethiopia, which is the traditional opponent of Somalia. And the Soviet Union switches sides. The Soviets were backing the Somali and decide to back the Ethiopians instead. And the war goes badly, and the dictator gets assassinated, and everything falls apart. And then the U.S. and the U.N. decide you can't possibly have a place without a government. And we have been attempting, with the assistance of the Ethiopian military, to reestablish government in Somalia ever since. And that is why you have a whole lot of chaos, especially around Mogadishu, which was the capital, because people in Somalia, especially around Mogadishu, figured out that if you're going to have a government, it's better to be the ruler than the ruled. And so they're fighting over who gets to be. Meanwhile, in northern Somalia, the locals have set up what they call the Republic of Somaliland, which nobody else will recognize, because if we recognize them, we'd have to admit Somalia wasn't one country, and we aren't willing to do that, and they seem to more or less run things all right. And I should say, my source for what I've just said is not just some crazy libertarian. My first source was a book written by a Dutch libertarian lawyer who lived in Somalia for, I think, his last 12 years, and then edited by an American libertarian. And I don't trust things written by people who agree with me, because I'm too likely to not see their mistakes. So I went looking for other sources. And it turned out that there is a retired London School of Economics anthropologist who has been studying Somalia since the 1950s, who is sufficiently prominent so that when I looked for books about the traditional Somali system, after finding some of his, I found another one, which was a fest trip in his honor written by other people. If you look online, I've actually got a link to it, I think, you can see his version of the story I just told you, which is roughly the version I told you. That is, his version certainly is that it's our fault, not the Somalis' fault, that Somalia is a mess. Anyway, that's one of the relatively modern systems, a few systems. How do you protect the weak? The Icelandic case is, in a sense, my favorite case. Because what happens in the Icelandic case is that tort claims are marketable. So I'm a elderly man with one son. That son gets killed by somebody. I'd like to sue the killer, but I know perfectly well that if I try to go to court, I'll get beaten up on the way. I don't have the resources to enforce my claim. Just like somebody in our system who can't afford a lawyer. What do I do? Well, my neighbor is a wealthy farmer with four big sons who went a Viking in their youth, and he's got lots of friends and relatives. So I say, look, this guy owes me 200 ounces of silver for killing my son. How'd you like to collect? And if collecting is easy, maybe I get 100 ounces and he gets 100 ounces. Collecting is hard, maybe he gets all of it. but by transferring the claim to somebody who can enforce it, I make sure that killing my son results in bad things happening to you, which means that my rights, or in this case my son's rights, are being protected. And I like to claim, in this particular respect, that the American legal system is a mere 1,000 years behind the cutting edge of legal technology, because arguably our tort system would work better with marketable torts. Imagine that somebody runs into your car. Maybe you can afford a lawyer, maybe you can't, but how do you know what lawyer will do a good job of winning the case for you? But if you just auction the case off, all you care is what law firm offers the largest sum of money for the right to collect your damages. All right? So this also, as I've discussed elsewhere, provides a better solution than class actions for a way of putting together a lot of small claims. But that would be another discussion. But basically, so that solves the problem. And the Somali case, as I mentioned before, you have these groups, what they refer to by various terms, the Diapang group was one group, was one reference, which are pre-existing groups. I'm already a member of it. And when someone violates my rights, it's the obligation of the other people to enforce it. That's what they've agreed to. I should say it's sort of fun looking at modern groups like the Somali to look at us through their eyes. To the Somali, a Diapang group that's entirely contract and not kinship, that's entirely people unrelated who have agreed to help each other, is referred to as a pile of shields. All right? That was their term for the U.S. alliance against the Soviets. All right? We and the Germans aren't relatives, but we've agreed to pool our resources, as it were, in order to be able to defend against our potential enemies. So how do you end feuds? So what happens if I think you wrong me, you don't pay damages, I harm you, review that as my wronging you and harm me and so forth and so on and so on and so forth, endless feud. And the main Icelandic solution is arbitration, that you don't like a situation where people are getting killed a whole lot, which is what can happen in these cases, so therefore you find some neutral parties, preferably important neutral parties, and you both agree to accept their settlement. If you read sagas, this happens all the time. There's a very, I suppose maybe the most famous of these cases, which is a very atypical one, is one in Njalsaga, where what's going on is that you have two men who are close friends and whose wives can't stand each other. And the wife of one of them is a rather unpleasant person. Oh, I could tell you more about Hogarthur, but I won't. And she arranges for one of her people to kill one of the minor people in the other one's household, at which point her husband hands the husband of the other one a purse of silver to pay damages for the killing. The wife on the other side arranges for one of her people to kill the person who did the first killing on the other side. Purse of silver goes back. And the purse of silver gets exchanged. I don't know, I think there are 4 or 5 or 6 people killed before the whole thing is over. But the two men never lose their friendship, which is really, in a sense, the point of the story. I'll tell you the end of that part of the story. One of the two men is a man called Gunnar, who is a very famous hero. And he gets outlawed and doesn't leave Iceland. And eventually his enemies come to kill him. And he is defending himself successfully with his bow. And the bowstring breaks. An enemy gets close enough to break it. And he drives them back with his halberd. And there's a break in the fighting. And he turns to Hogarthur, his wife, who has beautiful long blonde hair. And he says, "Cut me a strand of your long blonde hair that I may twist a bowstring out of it." And she says, "Does anything of importance depend upon it?" "Only my life." "Well, in that case, I'll remind you of that time you slapped me 3 years ago. And I don't care what happens to you or how long you hold out. I shall not ask you again. To each his own way of winning fame." So that's one of the famous passages in Njalsaga. So you can see why I like the sagas. They're actually very good stories. And his enemies attack, and he eventually gets killed. And the leader of the attackers asks Gunnar's mother for permission to use a part of her home field to bury his dead in. And she says, right, willingly I grant you that, and I wish only that you needed more of it. They're fun. Good stories. Anyway, so my favorite bit of the Somali solution is there's a point at which two fairly high-level groups, clans, have been feuding with each other. And the sensible people on both sides thinks it's a problem. There's been more killing than they like. So they agree to raise the wehrgeld, to raise the price for killing somebody. So they agree that now if one of your people kills somebody, you owe more money to the other side than before. That reduces, gives an incentive not to avoid killing people, which is sort of neat. But Finnish gypsies, the Kale gypsies, are a different gypsy group, a very different gypsy group. They're one of the strangest groups at all. They are a society which does not have the institution of marriage, and which, for public purposes, does not believe in the facts of human reproduction. They nonetheless manage to maintain themselves. That would be another story. But the Kale also have feuds, and they don't have a good mechanism for terminating feuds. So basically, when one family is feuding with another, what they do is not associate with each other. They just avoid seeing each other, having transactions together, any contact that could cause conflict, until it's gone long enough that everybody's forgotten about the feud, basically, which is probably a generation or so. So that's a different system. As you may be able to see, I've been having a lot of fun writing this book, because it's a way of learning about a lot of interesting different human societies, and I'm only giving you a sliver of it. I spent the last couple of months trying to improve my understanding of English criminal law in the 18th century, because that was a privately prosecuted system of criminal law. Not privately enforced, but you didn't have police or public prosecutors, so when somebody stole your horse, it was up to you to find out who, to get the evidence, to charge him, to prosecute him, and to get him hanged, or not, as whatever happened. So those are all different examples. So it's not like there is a single model of how a feud system works, but rather that a feud system is a general pattern which many different societies have used and implemented in different ways. So the stability of the system, what stops it? If my retaliation injures somebody who isn't outlawed, I owe damages to him or his heirs. So if I ignore court verdicts, it gets expensive. The coalition against me expands. Every time I kill or injure somebody on the other side, all his relatives now sue me. So the result is that if you look at it, most feuds either terminate by court verdict or more commonly by either arbitration or out-of-court settlement. The Somali, I described the wehrgeld, and the Kali, basically, they ignore each other until everybody's forgotten about it. I want to claim that there is evidence that a feud system is what many historical legal systems were built on, and is an easy case for our system, because Anglo-American common law grew out of Anglo-Saxon law, and Anglo-Saxon law is basically Icelandic law plus a king. That what happens is that the king claims that certain offenses are both offenses against the victim and offenses against the king's peace. For example, killing on a road or killing in the king's court. And gradually that expands and you end up with the modern system in which, as I hope all of you know, no one in this room will ever be the victim of a crime, legally speaking. Somebody kills you, you're not the victim. Right? If somebody kills me, who is the victim? State of California, right? Look at the case. The case will not be David Friedman versus Smith. It won't be David Friedman's heirs versus Smith. It'll be the state of California versus Smith. So that's how you get to a criminal system, basically by expanding violations of the king's peace, I think. Rabbinic law, which I think may be the best documented legal system in the history of the world. If you look at the history of Jewish law, You've got the Torah, which is basically part of the Old Testament, which goes back quite a long time. You then have, about 2,000 years ago, the Mishnah, which is a thick book which is a summary of the opinions of different scholars with regard to various legal issues. A little bit like modern casebook. And you then have, going on from that, you have the Talmud, which is commentaries on the Mishnah and is a mess. My theory for why in the 19th century so much of science was being done by Jews is that if you were a smart young Jewish man and you had the opportunity to do anything at all other than studying Talmud, you would leap at it. But anyway, that would be another talk. But in any case, the point I was going to make is that if you look at rabbinic law, you see what I think as evidence of fossilized feud. For example, you kill somebody. You are supposed to go to one of the cities of refuge and be escorted from there to the city where the killing occurred to be tried. And if the court decides that it was a capital killing, our equivalent of first-degree murder, you are supposed to be executed by the avenger of blood. Who is the avenger of blood? The heir of the person you killed. In other words, the person who would have had the responsibility for enforcing the Wehrgeld claim if it had been a feud system. Suppose the court finds that it's a non-capital killing. You are supposed to be escorted back to the city of refuge and remain there until the high priest dies. It's a sort of a exile of indefinite term, at which point you're free. If, however, the avenger of blood catches you on your way back to the city of refuge, he can kill you without penalty. So again, it's the remnants of a system where it was the job of the avenger of blood to kill. Furthermore, it is illegal for the avenger of blood to accept a money payment in order not to kill you, meaning that they are trying to block the Wehrgeld mechanism that I conjecture had existed in the pre-existing system. Another bit of rabbinic law that struck me as evidence, again, is that there's an... I should say, by the way, my main source, my favorite source for rabbinic law is Maimonides. At the point when Maimonides is writing, there has been no city of refuge for 1,000 years. All right, the kingdom of Israel was smashed by the Romans. Nonetheless, he writes as if all of this was a living system. You know, maybe the Messiah will show up, we will get the kingdom of Israel back, and after all, my students had better know what the law is when that happens. It's very hard to tell whether Maimonides really believes that or whether he just thinks that this is the complete logic of the system, I've got to lay all of it out. He's very good, I should say. I mean, he's, the problem with a lot of the sources on Jewish law is they consist of scholar X said this and scholar Y said that and so forth. And you never know what the right answer is. Maimonides, to every question, gives one answer, whatever he thinks is the best answer. Anyway, but one of the things he discusses is how the court handles ambiguous cases. So imagine that I've lent you some money, and we messed up in writing the document for the loan, and at one place in the document it says that you owe me 100 zuz, and in one place it says you owe me 200 zuz. Well, Maimonides says, the court can only make you pay me 100 zuz, because they can't enforce an obligation they're not sure is there. But, he goes on to say, if I have seized 200 zuz from you, the court can't make me give any of it back, because they aren't sure that you didn't owe it to me. All right? Well, the lesson I take is that he was imagining a system where people sometimes enforce their own claims. That's why I've seized 200 zuz from you. And that, again, suggests to me that this whole system is being built on top of a pre-existing feud system. In Islamic law, I should say, I believe that describing Islamic law as Sharia is a mistake. I think the correct, as far as I can tell, the correct understanding is that Sharia is what the law would be if God answered all your questions. That is, that Sharia is, as it were, the law in God's mind. Fiqh, which is jurisprudence, is the human attempt to figure out from the limited religious sources what the law ought to be. One of the neat things about Islamic law, by the way, is that in our legal system, we have a principle of separation of church and state. In the Islamic legal system, the separation is law and state. That doesn't mean that rulers never tried to impose their own law. Sometimes they did. The Ottomans in particular really did. But the theory of the system is that the law is deduced by religious scholars from the Quran and the traditions of what Muhammad and his companions did and said, basically. And all the ruler does is to appoint the judge who will then actually enforce the law. But one part of Islamic law is what's called jinniyat. And that's what happens if you kill or injure somebody. And the answer is that is a privately prosecuted system in which it is the kin of the person who's injured or the kin of the person who's killed. It's their obligation to basically take you to court. They don't have to enforce the verdict, but if what you've done is the equivalent of first-degree murder, they have the option of retaliation. They can choose to have you killed, or they can choose to accept a fixed money payment. That's the dia that I mentioned earlier, in exchange for not having you killed. And in the case of an injury, there's a complicated formula for how much damages you owe to a person. But all of it looks, again, like a pre-existing Bedouin feud system, which Muhammad then incorporated into his legal system so that instead of it being self-enforced, you've now got a court and, in effect, the equivalent of a state to enforce it. But the basic idea is that you were seeing killing or injury not as a crime against the state, but as a crime against the victim. Now, I'm oversimplifying a little bit because it's also a crime against God. And in addition to paying the damages, you were supposed to either free, I think, two believing slaves, two Muslim slaves, or else fast for 2 months. Muslim fast is only during the day, so you don't actually starve to death. But you can't eat or have sex during, or drink or have sex during daylight, essentially, which is the situation for the month of Ramadan. So if any of you are thinking of becoming Muslims, you might want to reconsider. Roman law, it's not as clear. I've got an article coming out in a book on Roman law, and we don't know nearly enough about the foundation. Roman law is sort of one of the other big major systems. That's what ultimately European law is largely built on top of. And the earliest source we have is something called the Law of the 12 Tables. Only we don't have it. It was their equivalent of the Constitution. It was sort of what they saw as their basic law. And somehow no complete copy has survived. I don't know how that happened, but there are lots of references to it in later Roman documents, so you can largely reconstruct it. And it seems to have reference to self-help remedies, to things you do yourself, to under what circumstances you can kill a thief if you catch him, and things like that. And later than the Law of 12 Tables, you have a system where getting the defendant to court is the obligation of the plaintiff, and where a verdict can give the plaintiff the right to seize the defendant, execute him, or sell him as a slave. So again, it looks as though it's being built on top of a previous feud system, though it's very hard to know because we don't have very good information on that. I have been unable to find enough about Chinese law, about very early Chinese law, to figure out whether it's based on a feud system or not. That's one of the other ancient legal systems that we have a significant amount of information about. I want to claim, however, that feud law is still around. And it's around in two senses. First, you have informal, below-the-radar versions of the traditional feud system, such as the Roman child who I mentioned, or the Sicilian mafia, or various other people. But in addition, I want to argue that you've got the structure of feud law in modern society. And my standard example, since I live and teach in Silicon Valley, is patent suits among high-tech companies. Let us imagine that you are Apple and you're thinking about suing Samsung, and assume for our purposes that Samsung is probably innocent. I don't have an opinion about the real suits in this case, so make it a hypothetical one. Suppose you say, probably we're going to lose this suit. We're going to claim they violated our patents. They probably didn't. But we might win it. After all, the law is uncertain. And even if we don't win it, take a long time for the suit to be settled. And during that time, people will be reluctant to buy Samsung phones, because if we win the suit, Samsung may have to remove some of the features of their phones. So we'll sell more iPhones. So let's do it. Oops, there's only one problem. Samsung can sue us. All right. So that means that Apple is going to be constrained about its willingness to sue on weak cases, because of the threat of retaliation. And in that system, the reason that right makes might is that it's easier to win a case when you're right. So therefore, if Samsung really violated Apple's patents, then Apple will probably win the case and collect quite a lot of damages. And if they didn't, they'll probably lose the case and have to spend lots on their lawyers. So therefore, the attack and the retaliation depend partly, though not entirely, on who's right. There is, however, a problem with this system. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the term patent troll, which is popular in certain circles. But it refers to what are more technically known as non-practicing entities. And a non-practicing entity is a firm which owns a bunch of patents but doesn't use any of them. The reason it owns patents is that so it can sue other people, claiming those other people are violating the patents and therefore ought to be paying royalties to the non-practicing entity that owns the patents. And the argument in favor of non-practicing entities is that the people who got the patents can sell it to the non-practicing entity. That gives you a reward for inventing something, even if you're not going to use it yourself. But the argument against is that they can go to a not terribly large firm and say, look, even if you win the case, by the time you win the case, you're going to be bankrupt because you have legal expenses. Why don't you give us a modest payment in royalties instead? What's the problem with NPEs from the standpoint of the feud system? The problem is that they are immune to retaliation because a non-practicing entity isn't using it, isn't making anything, so it can't be violating anybody's patents, so it can't be countersued. All right. And as you can see, that describes the system as a lot of people in the Silicon Valley legal area see it. I have a solution, however. This is not a feud system solution. This is a solution borrowed from the legal system of Pericles Athens a bit over 2,000 years ago, and is one which I've been arguing makes a good deal of sense in our legal system. And that is that in at least some equivalence of a tort case, we're not sure if it's true of all or not, if the plaintiff lost, he owed damages to the defendant. He owed damages which were a fixed percentage, I think a sixth, of the amount he had claimed the defendant owed him. Well, if you think about it as an economist, you say, look, we know that courts make mistakes. Suppose that when I sue an innocent person, there's a 10% chance I'm going to win because of court error. In that case, suing an innocent person imposes, in addition to legal costs, a 10% chance of paying damages. That's an injury. All right, well, what do we do to prevent people from doing things that injure people? We make them liable. Well, if the plaintiff wins, we treat the case as if we're sure that he's in the right. So if he loses, we could treat it as if we're sure that he's in the wrong, in which case he has sued an innocent person, in which case he owes that innocent person damages for the probabilistic injury because he could have won the case. So therefore, I have argued that the solution would be to impose on the non-practicing entity, when it loses the case, a damages equal to some fraction of what it claimed, and indeed that one could expand that to tort law in general. So it turns out that the American legal system is not merely 1,000 years behind the cutting edge of legal technology. We're 2,400 years behind the cutting edge of legal technology. All right. So if you want to see more of this stuff, my webpage is daviddfriedman.com, so it's pretty easy to remember. If I'd applied about 4 months earlier, I wouldn't have had to have the D in the middle of it, but someone beat me to daviddfriedman.com. And that's not the current. Go to daviddfriedman.com, and that still works, but I've actually moved the... I now have a copy of the book on someplace that has a much shorter URL than that. So I ought to update that. But from the webpage, you can find the link to the book pretty easily. You can also find the link to my blog, which consists of whatever I feel like talking about and therefore covers a very wide range of different subjects. And you can find links to the full texts of about 4 or 5 of my books and most of my published articles. Lots of other fun stuff. So, I guess that's really what I wanted to talk about. I haven't kept track of what time it is, but I assume that I haven't overrun my time yet, so we hopefully have a couple of minutes to take questions. Okay.
to Roman law.
Solon is Greek law.
When you did that, who did you see as the winners and losers, and how did that change the landscape?
I don't know. I'm not sure we even, that is, not only do I not know, I'm not sure anybody knows, in the sense that Solon is far enough back that we have imperfect information about what changes he really made. We know that he's credited with a bunch of changes. So I've got a chapter on Athenian law, and you can read it. I actually ought to. I should do some correcting of it. One of the things I'm doing in the book, by the way, I can't possibly be an expert in all of these different systems. So each chapter where I can, I find somebody who is an expert and ask him to read over the chapter and tell me what I've got wrong. And I did that for the Greek one, but I haven't yet incorporated the response I got. My most successful of those is for the one that I've just been working on, which is 18th century England. I got a response from John Beatty, who is probably the leading person in the field, three of whose books I've read, giving various comments and suggestions, which is very neat. In general, people who are serious enthusiasts like to talk to other people who are interested in their subject, even if you're not as expert as they are. So, not always, but I had pretty good luck. Yes?
So, this all sounds very good, but what would be a strategy to move society?
Yep.
Direction of these systems against it. I suppose that these societies that you had were they were very small, so you had a smaller group to coordinate with, and two, they emerged spontaneously.
Yes. But I think I attempted to answer that question a little over 40 years ago, though I didn't know that was what I was doing. That one of my conclusions after learning about all these systems was that when I wrote the part three of Machinery of Freedom, which is where I sketched my version of anarcho-capitalism, I was reinventing the wheel. That is to say that what I was describing there was a modern society version of a feud system. And it was more peaceful than the historical feud systems because I was assuming that all of the rights enforcement agencies would pre-contract with each other just for courts. But the basic logic of it was the same, that law enforcement was decentralized, private. So they're really asking two different questions. One of them is where do you want to go, and one of them is how do you get there? And in terms of where you want to go, what I argued then, and I think is still the right answer, is a society where there are private firms, which, in a sense, are the modern equivalent of the DIA collecting group in Somalia, only they're firms rather than coalitions. So you have a firm which sells you the service of protecting your rights and settling your disputes, that every such firm realizes that it has potential conflicts with other firms because their customers might have conflicts with its customers. So every pair of firms agree on a private arbitrator, a private court, whose verdicts they will accept. There is no government to enforce that agreement. What enforces that agreement is the fact that they're repeat players. That if my agency refuses to go along when their customer loses the lawsuit, then the other agency won't go along when his customer loses it. Then they have to fight each other. That's expensive. It means that they're providing a low quality of service to their customers because the wrong guy might win and they lose customers to more reasonable agencies. So that, I think, gives you a plausible model for what such a thing might look like. And I have part three of the original first edition of Machinery, I sketch that and discuss it some. And in the new third edition, I've got some additional material, part of it discussing what are the ways in which that might break down, under what circumstances would it break down, and so forth. But the question of how you get there is really a different issue. And I guess my view is that revolution is not a very sensible strategy, because people want government most for security, because they're afraid of being murdered and raped and robbed and burned down and such. And therefore, when you have a revolution, you tend to end up with people more inclined to want government, not less. So in my view, what you want to do, there are really several different strategies. One of them is creating alternative institutions, that abolishing the post office has become a much more practical idea now that we've got the UPS and FedEx delivering packages for us, similarly in other areas. So one thing is create private institutions that replace government institutions. One thing is what we're doing here, trying to spread ideas so that people don't take it for granted that governments are a sensible way of doing things in the way of solving it. If I generally view political activity by libertarians mostly as a PR campaign rather than a way of getting elected. That is, that it's mostly a way of getting ideas in circulation. And if we do it well enough and have any really popular ideas, the major parties will steal them from us, which is fine. That, after all, is how the Socialist Party won. So I guess that would be sort of my view of what you do. One way of putting it is that if you think about how a democratic system works, there is what I think of as the coarse control mechanism and the fine control mechanism. And the fine control mechanism is basically special interest lobbying. The coarse control mechanism is majority voting by ignorant voters. And that's driven by free information. It's driven by what everybody knows, whether true or false. All right? So one of the reasons not to give a lot of money in foreign aid is that everybody knows that the U.S. spends a lot of its budget in foreign aid. It doesn't have to be true, but it means that there's political pressure against it. One of the reasons to have a tariff is that everybody knows that tariffs protect American workers against Japanese workers. If you can spread the correct economics of foreign trade, which was worked out about 200 years ago by David Ricardo, then people will realize that a tariff protects American auto workers against American farmers, because one way of building cars is to build them in Detroit, and one way is to grow them in Iowa. And the way you grow cars in Iowa is you grow the raw material they're made out of, which is called wheat. You put it on a ship. You send the ship out into the Pacific, and it comes back with Hondas on it. All right? That's a mechanism for producing cars via trade, just like the others are mechanisms. So if you get people to intuit that, as it were, so that everybody takes it for granted that any politician who says, I'm protecting American jobs, is lying, becomes less popular. There are still reasons to vote for a tariff, because the auto industry will give you money if you vote for a tariff. But it becomes a more politically costly thing to do as more of the free information is accurate information in that case. So those are all things you do to try to change it. But you don't expect instant changes. So other questions? Lots of questions. Yes.
You talked about how few type systems would handle cases where there are tangible damages. What do you have to say, for how this type of system would handle coercion and threats of damages and retaliation for those types of things?
I'm not sure I see a big difference. That is, in a sense, threats only work if people believe you'll carry them out. And if you're carrying them out results in you getting sued and having to pay lots of damages, you probably won't carry them out. So I would have said that would be normally how you would handle that. Yes?
Living in Silicon Valley, do you find that a lot of the most successful companies up there are implementing these like tort systems and auction systems and stuff like that? Would you say like that's like an economic advantage to use those?
I'm not sure I understand you.
Like you're saying like we're 1,000 years behind in using the law, technology, and all that. I mean, Uber, for example, has competitors that are now starting to use auctioning systems to name prices. Same with Airbnb, has its big competitors are doing the same thing, auctioning off space instead of price.
Yes.
Right. I mean, like, do you find that, like, that's your common?
That's, I don't know. I haven't studied it, so I don't know.
Oh, okay.
That is, let's see. Right, yeah, you. It's fine. It's too hard to identify people. I was actually thinking of the guy behind you, but why don't you ask the question first?
Okay. Does dependence upon family component is not important? So let's say you have a person who has no family, or maybe another circumstance in which when you're the Viking system, where let's say you have a person who has family, but they all hate him, He shows up to the family events and he just kind of rude everybody. Meanwhile, so you don't really care much about the moral aspect. Meanwhile, the ability to collect the money would cause your neighbor to get all the silver. So there really isn't much of a point to going after the guy. So
I'm not sure I understand. That is to say, to begin with, just a technical point. Viking is a profession, not a nationality. Some of the Icelanders were Vikings. Most of them were. but so if you don't get along with your family, that's a problem in any society I can think of. And any wrong done directly to you, you could yourself go to court and do something about it. But if somebody kills you, your family would still like to collect money for it. So that's still a reason not to kill you, isn't it?
I'm talking about the circumstance you mentioned where it would be very difficult to collect, so your neighbors would be collecting all of
it. I understand. So in that case, yeah, so if you could imagine the case where your family consists of only your father and he hates you. So there is actually one of the sagas which starts out with a situation sort of like that, only it turns out much better as it works out. But so someone kills you, and your father says, "I'm not going to bother doing anything about it." Well, you're dead. Doesn't sound like a very good situation. Lots of situations can go. lots of things can go badly in almost any system. It doesn't seem to be a very likely one. And as long as there's the prospect of collecting some money, he's got an incentive to hand it to somebody else to collect it. Now, gentleman, right, with a bow tie.
When I've read a little bit about some of these systems, both your writings and others, one trend I consistently know that speaks this bit is the role of some degree of competition of some sort. Like, for example, the Somali system, you can choose which clan you want to belong to, and like, if you keep doing damages, your clan will expel you. I think something similar with the Icelandic, or there was a lecture by Mia Palagashvili that I went to talking about African chiefs and systems were like there. You couldn't leave your clan, you couldn't choose your clan. Your clan was like a hard set kinship. So what your whole clan could do was replace the chieftain with another until the British came in and started funding the chieftain and said this is the chieftain you'll always have forever, and so the system broke down. So less competition, but still, do they kind of work because you don't have a monopoly that can then extract people rent?
Yeah, that is one of my discussion, both in the first edition and in the current edition of Machinery. One of the ways in which my system can break down is if the economies of scale in the rights enforcement business are large enough to have only a small number of firms. You could then form a cartel and basically say stealing is more profitable than selling. So there are only three of us, and we'll agree that our customers are locked in. We won't accept your customers, you won't accept our customers, and we can now raise our prices almost as high as we want. So therefore, if you end up with a very small number of firms, it's not a stable system, and whether it's stable is going to depend whether you're likely to end up with three firms or 300. That's a point I made 40-some years ago, and it's true. Yeah, I don't believe that you can prove that something always works. I only think that I can make a plausible case that under some reasonable circumstances it will work. Stop. The sign back there told me I'm out of time. I think I'm supposed to...